Hello, my name is Justin the Clue, and I'm here today with
Will Sloan,
and you're listening to the Important Cinema Club. And today, it's a big one, because we're talking about a very important figure, Jonathan Rosenbaum.
That's right. If there was a Mount Rushmore for us, you know, an Important Cinema Club Mount Rushmore, this man would be on it. Because more than Roger Ebert, more than Pauline Kael, more than any other major American film critic, Jonathan Rosenbaum has been banging the drum across his career for really whatever has been most interesting and important in the medium at any given time.
I'm tired of people talking about Roger Ebert. Didn't grow up with Roger Ebert, didn't watch his reviews. When I read his reviews or even watch him, he's a pleasant man.
Yeah.
And other than the fact that he was what everybody was watching, there's no value to that for me because there's no nostalgia there.
Yeah. Well, have you ever thought about this though? What if a good movie was thumbs up? But hang on, it doesn't stop there.
Okay.
What if the bad movie was thumbs down?
What? And what if maybe his opinion was wrong every now and then? Let me just post clips of that. But what if I told you, Will, that at the time that Roger Ebert was doing this to a massive audience, there was another man in Chicago that was also writing about movies?
And you know, it's funny. I believe Ebert and Rosenbaum were friendly, at least.
Perhaps Rosenbaum may have thrown barbs Ebert's way.
Every now and then, which, you know, Ebert was on TV. He was probably like, you know, pissing in the Grand Canyon at that point. But it's funny. Rosenbaum is briefly mentioned in Ebert's autobiography, Life Itself.
Really?
Where he's talking about sort of the film criticism landscape. I don't have the book in front of me, but he says something along the lines of, oh, and you know, the Chicago Reader has a great history of sort of contrarian film criticism. And he uses that word, I think, rather neutrally. But nevertheless, embedded in that, contrarian is a sort of like, that's nice over there.
Yeah, you know, he's trying to do something different. I don't think I would call Jonathan Rosenbaum a contrarian critic. Would you?
No, I wouldn't. Although, I mean, so the word contrarian, so Armand White is the classic case of the contrarian movie critic, because when culture zigs, he zags.
Yes.
But even in Armand White, I mean, Armand White is a genuinely discontented fellow.
And his reviews, because they need to be against whatever is popular, sometimes read like word salad.
But also, like, because Armand White hates what he perceives to be the status quo, he zags the other way. And so within that, I think what I'm trying to say is there's a value judgment in contrarianism, the word contrarianism, that I don't like, particularly even with Jonathan Rosenbaum, who I think has been right more, you know, he's been on the right side of history for an awful lot of things for an awful long time.
People may be wondering, why Jonathan Rosenbaum? And I think we need to set that down in stone. Principally, we love him.
Oh,
we
yeah.
love his writing. I think he may be my favorite critic ever.
I love his writing. I love his perspective. I've been reading him for so long that it's like a warm bath at this point. His quirks, his peculiarities, his weaknesses even. I love it all. I love the, you know, things that come up over and over and over again.
Hey, did you hear that Jonathan Rosenbaum spent some time in France?
Yes.
They're a little bit more illuminated than America.
He interviewed Orson Welles once in the early 1970s.
About it again and again and again.
And I love that about him. I love his pugnacious spirit. I love his politics. I love his taste.
And Jonathan Rosenbaum is not somebody that I grew up with. He is a critic that I just stumbled upon at the York University Library. And I think the reason I did was that he has a book called Essential Cinema. And I think I saw it on
the
shelf and I pulled it off and I went, what the heck is this? Started reading. Boom. Wanted to read everything that he wrote.
That's interesting. The first book that I read, I guess I would have been in high school, was Movie Wars. And I found that at the Richview Library in Etobicoke. I think it was and is his most widely distributed book because it's the most polemical. The subtitle of it is How Hollywood and the Media Limit What Movies We Can See. And it's a series of essays sort of explaining, you know, why art cinema distribution is so bad. It's an interesting time capsule, this book, because his two biggest targets are probably the American Film Institute, which just had, you know, their big top 100 list, but especially Miramax and Harvey and Bob Weinstein.
And he's right. They were terrible, awful, not just as people, but as business entities.
And he was making the case, too, that, you know, Harvey and Bob Weinstein, who had a sort of near monopoly on art film distribution in North America at that time, you know, their taste set the horizons of what you could see. And it's funny, when you look at the things that Rosenbaum was advocating over the years, like, huh, can you believe a 7-hour Hungarian film about poverty that's in black and white? Or, huh, why is he talking about all this stuff from Iran? Aren't we enemies with Iran?
Why would I want to watch a movie like that? As Rosenbaum says himself, boy, I could see 3 to 4 bad movies instead of seeing one good one, like Satan Tango.
And that's the thing. Like, you look at the sort of stuff that Miramax and Harvey Weinstein were distributing in the 90s, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, or
all the Hong Kong films they would recut and put out to the market because they knew better to cut those down for American audiences.
Well, that's another thing. That's another bugaboo of Rosenbaum's, where the monopoly that Miramax had extended to, they would buy all these movies. They bought Through the Olive Trees by Kiarostami and just didn't release it. They would buy, all those Hong Kong martial arts films and
wouldn't even let people import them.
Yes. And so much of that was just to have them, like, they didn't even intend to really release them, just to have a monopoly. Or when they did release them, especially with those Hong Kong movies that Rosenbaum's not that interested in, but they would release them in versions cut of 10 or 20 minutes, dubbed. Those would be the only versions you could find, with the logic of, well, it's got to play in Peoria, right? Meanwhile, here we are, Harvey Weinstein's behind bars and things like Parasite or
huge,
or Shin Godzilla, or all sorts of foreign movies
that were not modified in any way for North American audiences, and they're doing gangbusters. So I thought it would be interesting to pick some articles, maybe some of them are our favorites, that Rosenbaum has written, and then discuss them. But before that, let's talk a little bit about Rosenbaum's background, even though there is no big dramatic history there.
Yeah, there's no like dramatic history, but certainly there are events.
Building blocks
that he returns to again and again that were foundational in his perspective. He was born in 1943, grew up in Alabama, I believe. He came from a long line of movie theater owners in the South.
Which comes up again and again that he grew up with the movies.
And he grew up Jewish in the South. And I'm sure both his Jewish upbringing and his Southern upbringing have an interesting role to play in the kind of critic he became. I understand that when he went to college in the 60s, he intended to become a novelist. And in fact,
he studied literature.
Yeah. And his first published book, Moving Places, a sort of literary autobiography, is his one sort of published attempt at capital L literature. But foundational for him was the years that he spent in Europe after college. He lived in both Paris and London.
He visited sets like Robert Bresson's movies.
I'm not sure if he visited the set of Playtime, but he certainly interviewed Tati around that time. In fact, I think knew Jacques Tati a little bit.
He hung out at the Cinémathèque Française a lot. And all of this stuff is building blocks that when he finally ends up in Chicago and writing for the Chicago Reader, he always looks back at this better time of what, experiencing movies could be.
Yeah, I mean, he often alludes to Europe, or at least the Europe that he knew as a younger man, as being a time that was more welcoming of art, more democratic towards art. The idea that art wasn't something that was in an ivory tower. Also, something that often comes up, of the major American critics, he's the one whose taste is, for want of a better word, the most French,
Jerry Lewis
and, other, French auteurist cause celebs.
He can get a filmmaker, get obsessed with him, and then write about him over and over and over again. Even like, it's like characters that reappear throughout his writing. Oh, there's a little Luc Moulet appearance in one of his reviews.
And all of this is foundational to his perspective. Central to his work is that he's very skeptical of the forces of marketing, the way they're shaped by ideology, particularly in an American context, and how marketing itself defines our cultural horizons. So, his work is often very polemical, but it's also rarely, I would say, definitive. Unlike Pauline Kael, who famously claimed she never saw a movie more than once, he's always revisiting his old judgments in the now dearly departed CinemaScope magazine. He had a great DVD column.
Oh, me and Will get so excited. Ripping open our new issue of CinemaScope, we're going right to the Rosenbaum DVD column.
Going straight to Rosenbaum, because particularly in his later years, it was like late-style film criticism. It's like, like, I'm not sure what it would have been like to have read that column and not have had a deep like
understanding of his previous work. Yeah, it was like opening a door straight into his brain and then getting all the stream of consciousness thoughts.
And I mean, politically, he's on the left. He's skeptical of capitalism and imperialism and especially American hegemony and all that good stuff. He's sympathetic to filmmakers who are skeptical of that as well. And, you know, when a Roger Ebert or someone like that will refer to him as a contrarian, a lot of that is because he's going against the grain of very deeply embedded things in American capitalist ideology.
Wait, he doesn't like Star Wars? As one Amazon review of one of his books says.
Well, another great example is at a time when Elaine May's Ishtar was a punchline, he wrote a very favorable review of it. Made a case for it as a truthful satire of American foreign policy. And Ishtar is one of those movies that's loved by a lot of people now.
And at the time, no one liked Ishtar.
No, that would have seemed like just pure, like, rank contrarianism. But there's a method to his madness.
And I think what's most important to me about his writing is it makes me excited about filmmakers or films that I know nothing about. That he is able to weave a tapestry. He is able to illuminate me to subjects that by the time that I'm done reading his essay or review about them, I need to see these movies. And they may even become obsessions of mine, just like they are obsessions of Jonathan Rosenbaum.
Well, he's the most international of film critics, but also central to what makes him great is his belief that art is for everyone. So like when I was reading Movie Wars as a teenager, and he'd be going on and on about how bad it was that Miramax had their mediocre movies that they were shoveling onto the public while they're suppressing great films like, you know, Kiarostami's Through the Olive Trees or the restoration of Jacques Tati's Jour de Fête, I would be thinking, well, yeah, sure, but like, will it play in Peoria? You know, so deeply embedded is the marketing speak. But I don't know, here we are 20 years later, and you look at like the places where the cinephiles converge, the Criterion Channel, MUBI, stuff like that. I think it is so much more reflective of Jonathan Rosenbaum's taste than it is Harvey Weinstein's now.
100%. If you look at one of the essays that he wrote against the AFI's top 100 American films, he gives an alternative list of films. Almost all of those movies are now considered like classics in cinephile circles.
Well, actually, let's talk about that essay because that's the first one I wanted to bring up. It's called Listomania, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love American Movies. So this essay was first published in June 1998. It was a response to the American Film Institute's list of the 100 greatest movies. And, you know, if you were around at the time, you know that list.
It has an alternate title in Movie Wars, The AFI's Contribution to Movie Hell.
Yeah. So that list, you know, published in 1998, you know it, you love it. Number one, Citizen Kane. Number two, Casablanca. Number three, The Godfather. But beyond that, and look, I like those movies a lot. Mm. But beyond that, on that list, you'll see a lot of very dusty old classics.
Oh, yeah. We've gone through this list on one of our Patreon episodes, and especially near the bottom, Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, The Jazz Singer, The Sound of Music, Giant, you know, movies that were kind of coasting on the fumes of their old reputation.
And I think what's important about his essay going against this list is he makes a very clear-eyed case why this list is terrible. And he even talks about what his alternate list exists for and how he even went into it wanting films that would be on the surface level enjoyable. These are not challenging or contrarian films in his list. They're films that he genuinely loves and he thinks other people should see.
But you know, it's interesting, his idea of what's pleasurable is different from the AFI's, because one of the points he makes in this essay is, well, of course, the AFI's list is full of movies that sort of perpetuate the lies that America tells itself, you know?
He talks about how Jack Valenti in the AFI 3-hour special discusses how To Kill a Mockingbird was the first American film to deal with the racial situation in America.
Like,
what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, the first one ever. But, you know, I'm also reminded of another essay that Rosenbaum wrote called Towards the Devaluation of Woody Allen, where it begins with a full-throated defense of Jerry Lewis, who at the time was quite out of favor amongst the American intelligence. intelligentsia. And it was made, and it made a case that, well, the American middlebrow intellectuals like Woody Allen because he flatters them. He creates a sort of New Yorker reading, pseudo erudite vision of middle class life.
But, all white.
Yeah, all white. But you know, Jerry Lewis shows you who you really are. And I, you know.
Here's the thing about J-Ro, though. We call him J-Ro because he's a friend of ours.
Yeah.
Is that you can disagree with him of the some of the things that he writes, especially the things that come up again and again. But within that, you know, oh, I don't know if I agree about that. There will be points of just pure, oh, wow, he gets it. Or he's making me see these under a different light. Like that devaluation of Woody Allen is so good because even if you disagree with some of the stuff, I agree with most of it, you understand it there.
I've never been able to get it out of my head. The comparison of what Jerry Lewis is doing to what Woody Allen's doing, it's like, It may sound initially crazy, but I think there's a deep truth to it. But that list, his alternate canon of the top 100 movies, yeah, look at that list compared to what the AFI did, because it includes, just to name a few, Cat People, The Heartbreak Kid, Freaks, Eraserhead, Do the Right Thing, The Black Cat, Rio Bravo, The Phoenix City Story, Wanda, Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, Zabriskie Point.
Everybody listening to this knows those movies, but they're nowhere on the AFI Top 100 list.
And in fact, in 1998, if you said a lot of those movies, that would have sounded to a lot of people like contrarianism.
Mm. But, what? The Black Cat? A universal horror film on the top 100 American films? Get out of here!
Or like Wanda? What even is Wanda? Mm. That's what they would have said. Or even like Zabriskie Point,
The
bad Antonioni film, which has aged like a fine wine, if you ask me.
So one of the kind of main points Rosenbaum brings up again and again is railing against the idea of canon, of like, these are the things that you should watch. All of his most passionate work is always like, no, don't listen to what the mainstream has to tell you. There's so much better work out there that you should be exploring and going to watch yourself.
It's funny, that book, Essential Cinema, the subtitle of it is On the Necessity of Film Canons. And it's like he's drawing a distinction between the canon and canons.
Yes, canons are important, but the canon should be dismissed. So I want to bring up a review that when I mentioned it, Will was like, of course we have to talk about that, which is his review, Ace Ventura Reconsidered.
And by the way, if you want to look it up online, it's on his website under the title, Why Is This Movie a Hit?
So almost all of the articles that we're mentioning in this episode can be found online because he has a massive archive of all his writings. Mm-hmm. So Ace Ventura Reconsidered was written after, you know, Ace Ventura had come out and had been a hit. And
a surprise hit.
Yeah, Rosenbaum was a critic. He had seen the movie at a press screening, had dismissed it as, no one's going to like this. And then once it was a hit, he went back, like Andrew Saris in 2001, to see, like, what is behind this?
And the essay is amazing because he doesn't like the movie. He doesn't find it funny. No. But it is a very earnest attempt to look at it from every possible angle.
Yes.
And try to see, why is this working?
He even says, okay, Luc Mollet has a short film, Un Steak Trop Cuit, where it's about brother and sister kind of grossing each other out. Why do I say I like that, but I don't like Ace Ventura? Now, he tries to make the case, oh, well, it's because it's about, you know, sibling kind of a relationship there, that there's a love.
There's a tenderness.
Ace Ventura doesn't have that. I would have to say he probably doesn't like it. He probably likes the Luc Mollet one because people don't like that Luc Mollet film because it's lost and because it's kind of forgotten and underground.
Well, maybe, but you can tell in the article that there's something about the Ace Ventura character that's chafing against
him. Yeah, he does not like it.
And it's like he makes a perceptive, I think, comparison between Ace Ventura and Andrew Dice Clay's Ford Fairlane.
Yes.
Where it's like they're both these, like, you know, macho characters, one of whom is sort of a reactionary, the other of which is a sort of animal-loving, you know, macho progressive. But he also makes the case, as the article goes on, that Ace Ventura sort of positions himself in opposition to the world. You know, he loves animals, but he hates people. And in fact, Rosenbaum was fairly ahead of his time in pointing out the transphobic finale of the film. He refers to it as a xenophobic finale.
Mm-hmm. So Rosenbaum, arguably on the right side of history when it comes to Ace Ventura, which, let's be honest, me and Will, big smile on our faces just thinking about Ace Ventura.
A movie of low lows and high highs, if you ask me.
You know what? Rosenbaum admits at laughing at arguably the funniest part in Ace Ventura when he pretends to be in slow motion.
The slow motion scene, yeah.
But this review or reconsideration of Ace Ventura, it really peaks at the end where there's a giant paragraph where he talks about earlier generations were linked primarily by wars and social movements. But a recent movie like Reality Bites suggests that the members of Generation X, a concept manufactured by TV, are linked only by their experiences of 70s TV shows. This suggests that if you're in that age group and you weren't watching TV back then, poor sap, you don't belong to any generation. Even worse, it suggests that wars and social movements, present and future, may be only TV shows or video games to begin with. It's easy to imagine that Generation Y will be defined by the video games they played and Generation Z by their software programs. Oh, Jonathan Rosenbaum, you got us! And then it goes on and on. If Andy Warhol's famous utopian remarks, anyway, it like builds out and out and out, looking like a further universal picture, and then it ends with, "But humans being without computers or TVs implicitly deserves only our scorn, the kind that Ace dishes out in gleeful abundance to fellow slum dwellers as well as billionaires, and punishment to be provided by our costly crime legislation." I still don't like this movie. So good.
I love that. Well, speaking of comedians, this may be my favorite piece of film criticism ever, honestly. It's Declarations of Independence. His review of your sign. Yeah. His review of Hardly Working.
As I look at a Hardly Working poster, an original one sheet that was gifted to us that is framed behind you.
Yep, here at the ICC offices. This was published in April 1981 in the Soho News. And, you know, even if you're a Jerry Lewis fan, Hardly Working is a bit of a difficult proposition. Mm. Well, it was widely hated at the time. First of all, I just love Rosenbaum's opening paragraph.
And it should be noted, this review was written at the time of the film's release.
That's right. He was basically the only critic who was making a case for this movie. And you know, the movie itself, Hardly Working, all of the like 60s Jerry Lewis movies, you may not find them funny, but the productions were immaculate. Mm-hmm. You know, beautiful Hollywood dream world productions. And Hardly Working was made independently in Florida on found locations. Jerry looking old, looking like shit, doing the same old shtick. And it's a movie that comes to theaters with a big kick me sign on its back. Mm-hmm. Well, the article begins, "My dream scenario runs roughly like this. J.D. Salinger finally relents and allows Jerry Lewis to direct a film based on Catcher in the Rye. Salinger's sister told me if anyone could get it from him, it would be me," Lewis remarked in a 1977 interview. "And civilization as we know it collapses. In the ensuing sociocultural upheaval occasioned by the destruction of two critical reputations, anarchy reigns supreme. Mad dogs roam the street. The New Yorker shrivels to a cinder out of an acute, well-mannered embarrassment. And all of those distinguished gray eminences in my profession who fear and loathe Lewis for what he says about their own bodies and social discomforts, some of whom shrink in terror from Tati for the same reasons, run screaming off to the Hamptons and Berkshires to write their own fiction, never to return." And then, you know, the article continues to crescendo where he points out that he speaks of the diminished cinematic marketplace in the United States, you know, a marketplace where masterpieces by Ackerman, Bresson, Girard, Godard, Rivette are not even getting art house distribution anymore.
I mean, but he also says, and he kind of lays his card out on the table, that starting a paragraph with "a passionate Jerry Lewis fan since age 7. I followed him religiously." It's like, aha, there you go. There's a skeleton key of this review.
Absolutely. "Truffaut discovered the box office secret years ago. Your degree of seriousness and complexity is often gouged by your capacity to deal exclusively with the middle class. Hardly Working, which deals with the working class and unemployment and speaks directly to the racially, culturally, and economically disenfranchised, to judge by the delighted audiences I've been seeing with, doesn't rate on this scale at all."
Now, reading this review, it makes me want to jump in a million different directions because he talks about things that are fascinating and I may not know about, or especially when I read this back in the day, naming, you know, film critics. He actually roasts the 1979 The Film Encyclopedia because it doesn't include Michael Snow's name. He talks about seeing a Michael Snow film in Toronto, and he even goes, Directorially, it's perhaps his most mannerist films, particularly in its reaction shots, as mannerist as Sexette or Redline 7000 or Eraserhead. And I'm like, what does that mean?
The dizzying number of references. It's as painfully direct about lost stamina as Mad Wednesday or A King in New York, and not merely where Lewis is concerned. The sad, weary features of Harold J. Stone also compose a memorable sight.
And he even mentions, on a conventional level, it hardly works at all.
Yeah, that's right. He says, as a key document of the Reagan era, it is the only one to date I can even begin to identify with. It is also unbearable, beautiful, terrible, wonderful, stupid, brilliant, awful, shocking, inept, and even very funny in various alternating stretches.
So you read that sentence, and almost separated from it, you would go, well, this means nothing, because it's everything. But why is it when I read this, I'm like, you know what? I'm buying. What are you saying here?
I think it's because, like, you're buying what he's saying because the movie is like, strange in a very evocative way. It's like you've got an old Jerry Lewis in diminished circumstances doing the same old shtick. And maybe it's not working the way Jerry intended it to, but it's working in some way. And it's working in that context. And I actually feel like he is, like, positioning Hardly Working, which in many ways is not an artistic success, as being a sort of, like, accidental documentary and a poignant documentary about, like, disillusionment and decline and diminished expectations in the Reagan era. I don't know. There's something powerful about that.
And you know what? You read it and you go, you know what? I buy it. And even if you don't like Hardly Working when you watch it, which is reaction. I know you love it.
I love it. But no, I've gone through many different reactions with that movie. First time I saw Hardly Working, I was like, what is this?
Yeah, exactly. But now you're like, ah, God level. But then when you watch The Nutty Professor, you're like, what is this?
I would rather watch Hardly Working than The Nutty Professor now.
I absolutely agree with you. Yeah. Now, we haven't even really talked about the essays that really caught me into Jonathan Rosenbaum were the ones where they're basically introductory courses to a filmmaker, especially ones that you've never read before. I will say that, like, oftentimes when I read about filmmakers I don't know in perhaps a magazine, there's not always an entryway into it. I'm going to say CinemaScope, a magazine I love, rest in peace. There would often be articles that I would read them about stuff I don't know, and there was no entry point into it. I'd be like, well, I don't know what anything this is, and I've read the whole article.
Right.
Jonathan Rosenbaum does not do that. It's almost like he's opening a door for you and just, like, helping you in. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, oh, you can go up to the next room if you want. And I always want to, just by the way that he writes about it. For example, in A la recherche de Luc Mollet, 25 propositions.
Where now, who is Luc Mollet?
Luc Mollet is a filmmaker that was part of the French New Wave that no one remembers. He, Chabrol.
Rivette,
which I will say that I learned about from Jonathan Rosenbaum, and he's a huge backer of Rivette. Especially, he loves talking about Out One.
Right.
Rivette's, like, super long serial / movie.
Yeah, I remember when I was first reading Rosenbaum as a teenager and being like, my God, how is it always that he likes the one that's 7 hours long?
Yes. And Luc Mollet, he was around with all those guys. And I gotta say, Luc Mollet, king, still alive, still doing interviews.
Last man standing.
But his films did not even get distribution in France, even though that they would star people like Jean-Pierre Léaud, the star of, you know, The 400 Blows, and he's in La Chinoise as well.
Which is remarkable, because you would actually think Luc Mollet's films are some of the most accessible to come out of this, you know.
But they're very inexpensive looking, and they're also comedies, which you get the sense that distributors are like, what are we supposed to do with this? Mm-hmm. Because Luc Mollet, he was the guy that loved Edgar G. Ulmer probably more than anyone. He's the one that coined the famous, morality is a matter of tracking shots, la morale est affaire de travelings. And then later on, Godard would say, tracking shots are a moral affair, and that's the one that people quote, not the original Luc Mollet one, where the words are just switched around.
My favorite Luc Mollet Mont is when he's talking about Samuel Fuller, and he says, off the top of my head, I think he says, on the subject of fascism, only the perspective of someone who has been tempted is of interest.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, this review starts right away with, every film by Gerd Oswald deserves a long review. Luc Mollet, 1958.
Yeah.
And me and you, what we do is, who's Gerd Oswald? I don't know who that is. We're going to explore more of this. And this article, the way that it's broken down, is just like 25 points. So there isn't any kind of long long summary of anything. You just get an idea of the filmmaking, of Luc Moulin's critical opinions when he would write about The Tarnished Angels. One of the multiple styles of Douglas Sirk is marked by the fillings out of nothingness, the higher bid, the incantation, yielding Summer Storm or Written on the Wind, which one could call Filmed on the Wind. And it's like, oh, wow, this Luc Moulin guy, he sounds really interesting. And Rosenbaum, using these 25 points, creates a picture of a filmmaker that you probably did not know before you started reading this, but now you want to know everything about. And he makes it even more tantalizing by saying stuff like, you know, I've only seen 2.5 of his films, and that may be the most amount of his films that I'll ever see based on how they're being released. But, you know, as a reader, you're like, well, I need to see as many that are available now. And they're still difficult to see if you wanted to see them.
I know. We should start just posting them online.
They were released on DVD in a box set more than a decade ago, and they have not come out of North America in any other form since then. For people who want more information about Luc Moulin, we did a whole episode about him. I mean, we didn't even mention Luc Moulin made the greatest film about being a cinephile ever made, called Le Siège d'Alcazar, that you have to see if you haven't seen it.
That's right. English translation of that would be The Seats of the Alcazar.
Mm-hmm, which is Alcazar being a theater.
Yeah. If we had a Mount Rushmore of movies for this podcast, yeah, that would be one of them.
Absolutely one of them.
So here's an article, one of his most well-known articles, The Best of Both Worlds, which is his review of AI, Artificial Intelligence. Again, a movie that, while not exactly poorly received, was certainly greeted as lesser Spielberg.
And let's take a step back and say that Jonathan Rosenbaum, not a fan of Spielberg.
Yeah. In fact, he's one of those critics who sort of regards Spielberg as like the dumbing down of, like over and over again. He was quite forward thinking, in fact, reviewing things like Raiders from the Lost Ark and sort of calling it, you know, racist or colonialist. Or, you know, he has an interesting review of Schindler's List that sort of like,
he liked it,
but
he's like fighting against that,
not a lot. And his and it's George Lucas, but his review of Star Wars is
when,
like,
Star Wars came out,
which is like, he really kind of loses his cool on Star Wars. He's comparing it to Triumph of the Will and all that, which, you know, I mean,
he was kind of right in a way.
Well, the thing is, Lucas did take aesthetics from Triumph of the Will.
Yeah,
so you can't deny that. But in this review, I mean, Rosenbaum may not be a fan of Spielberg, but he's very engaged with him. And in this review, which, of course, AI was a Kubrick project that was completed and realized by Steven Spielberg, he does a good job articulating the sensibilities and differences and similarities of both Kubrick and Spielberg. You know, he's more of a Kubrick fan, but he makes a good case of it being a productive mix, but he does a good job articulating the film as a mix of the sensibilities and a sort of space for the sensibilities to challenge each other, where all of the Spielberg like gooey tendencies are rendered strange and all the Kubrickian sort of cerebral tendencies are rendered
given emotion.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing that I love in this essay is, you know, he's always sniping at other critics, which I find hilarious.
Always.
And, you know, you can call it petty sniping, but then there is also a sort of like deep undercurrent of like a polemical agenda to it.
Well,
like,
he's sniping usually at critics above him that have a much bigger readership than someone like he would have.
And he hates the sort of received wisdom that they embody. So in this review of AI, he says, David Denby writes in The New Yorker, "Whatever is wrong with AI, and a great deal is wrong, it's the first American movie of the year made by an artist. He's not only trashing the work of hundreds of filmmakers whose work he hasn't seen, which must come from yearning for a world much simpler than our own, a yearning Spielberg generally speaks to, but is also making it clear that he has only one artist in mind, and it isn't Kubrick. Denby treated Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick's final film, with the kind of dismissive contempt that would have seemed excessive if it had been ladled on a James Bond feature, and I can only surmise that for him, Kubrick doesn't even qualify as a bad artist, alive or dead. So Denby must have been hoping for another Spielberg film, much as I was hoping, even less realistically, for another Kubrick."
And the thing about Rosenbaum is that if you saw his positive review of AI, you may think, well, I guess Roger Ebert is right. He is contrarian because people didn't like AI, but of course Rosenbaum likes it. But it's consistent with all the stuff that he's discussed before.
I mean, he does a good job articulating exactly how AI works. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the, you know, much debated last act of AI, which a lot of people think it goes on too long.
A lot of people say, oh, well, Spielberg wanted to give the movie a happy ending. And Rosenbaum clues in that that's not what the movie's about.
That's right. He writes, it sounds like typical Spielberg goo, for better and for worse. And when you're watching the film, it feels that way. But the minute you start thinking about it, it's at least as grim as any other future in Kubrick's work. Humankind's final gasp belongs to a fucked up boy robot with an Oedipus complex who's in bed with his adopted mother and who finally becomes a real boy at the very moment that he seemingly auto-destructs.
Yeah, like, he gets it. Yeah. He got AI when nobody else was getting it at the time.
Spielberg rendered strange, Kubrick rendered Spielbergian.
Mm. And so the last thing I think we'll talk about is the critical reception of Small Soldiers.
Oh. Speaking of Spielberg, I love this article.
Now, this is basically Rosenbaum comparing Small Soldiers, which was considered a failure, to Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan.
And these are two films that came out like within 2 weeks of each other, both from Steven Spielberg's company, one of which is White Elephant Art, the other of which is Termite Art.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Joe Dante Small Soldiers, a children's movie with a Burger King tie-in.
Now, I love this essay, but I'm going to say right off the bat, I don't like Small Soldiers very much.
Yeah.
You said the same thing when we did our Joe Dante episode.
I haven't seen Small Soldiers in years and years, but I think if I saw it again, I would probably like Small Soldiers is a movie where like I like the sprinkles more than the donut, if that makes sense.
Like, I don't think the broad ideas of what the movie's trying to do work as well as I hope it would. But what Rosenbaum says in his essay about how Small Soldiers is much more interesting as an anti-military film than Saving Private Ryan,
which is pure flag waving,
which positions itself as like, ah, yes, you know, this has to be an anti-war film because of the way that it shows the war, even though that it will just lead more people to join the military, hoping that they could be the good guy on the team.
Right, right.
And he is absolutely correct in the way that he kind of breaks down what both movies represent. And I think that, like, that's where Rosenbaum is his most interesting, is that when I maybe slightly disagree with the quality of a certain film, but then I can agree with Rosenbaum's perspective on it and how the movies can be interpreted by like a general public.
Just while we're still on the subject of Rosenbaum, if I have like a complaint about him and and like he may be, who knows, he could be listening right now. And if he is, I'm sure he has a good rebuttal to anything I'm going to say.
Yes. Jonathan, if you're listening,
you're my hero.
Yeah, we agree with you. You don't need to write anything.
You're so much smarter than me. Yes. I want to be like you when you grow up.
When you grow up.
Yes, when I grow up.
Not when Rosenbaum. When,
I can't even think anymore.
Yes. Just the sheer idea of Jonathan Rosenbaum, I assume, wearing gigantic earphones, listening to an iPod, this podcast.
Well, the thing that I've always found, I think, most appealing about him is his belief that art is for everybody. And he's like, just because Satan Tango is a 7-hour black and white Hungarian film doesn't mean people can't understand it and that they won't enjoy it. And there's a whole like marketing media apparatus built to, you know, it in service of corporate interest to tell us that actually you would rather watch, I don't know, whatever, some Harvey Weinstein thing than Satan Tango, even though you'll like Satan Tango. Mm. One thing, his blind spot, I think, is trash. Like,
yes,
you know, exploitation or paracinema. Like, to him, Jess Franco is simply the person who mutilated Orson Welles' Don Quixote. Gary Graver will only exist in relation to Orson Welles for him.
I think that another, if I had a criticism of Jonathan Rosenbaum, we've mentioned it before, he can get very petty about things to the point that one of his books is just about how other people have gotten Orson Welles wrong.
Oh yeah, I love that book.
I know, but it is kind of like,
yeah,
oh, you guys got it all wrong.
What he's going after, most of his targets I agree with, but yeah, it is funny to see him keep coming back after David Denby or Janet Maslin again and again and again.
Or like biographies about Orson Welles, or things like that.
David Thompson, yeah.
I mean, that is a ripe target that I agree with.
Yeah, but I mean, he was like punching up.
Yes, he was.
To use a phrase like that. And it's just interesting how impactful he's been. I mean, I really do think I see Jonathan Rosenbaum's influence much more strongly than Roger Ebert's. Even though he chose the path, I think he very consciously chose the path of, you know, writing for alternative publications. Mm-hmm. He wrote one article for the New York Times, and
it's not a good one.
It's not, even he would say it's not a good one. And one of the reasons why he doesn't like it is because it was so fit into being like a kind of hot take article. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, after Ingmar Bergman died, he wrote an article about like why Ingmar Bergman is overrated, mm-hmm. which the whole framing of that, the whole tone of it is, you know, his writing is meandering. It's digressive. It's constantly interrogating itself.
It's also theatrical and isolated. Mm-hmm. And that's basically his case of why Bergman is overrated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he also says, and people don't really talk about Bergman anymore. And I was like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, the article's not that great. And I mean, I think he more or less disowns it. And he was much better. And he very consciously chose the path of operating in spaces where he could, write with great freedom at great length, mm-hmm. away from somebody like, you know, somebody like Roger Ebert sought the mainstream. He sought to be a middleman between Harvey Weinstein's of the world and the audience. And Rosenbaum sought the role of being a dissenting voice.
And he did it eloquently, interestingly, and always filled with insight and recommendations, which is why, again, he's our favorite critic. We love him.
I give him two thumbs up.
Which you would probably hate to hear.
Yeah.
If people want to actually check out his writing, he's online. He's on Twitter still, I believe.
You can probably talk to him right now.
Don't look at his Twitter profile if you're at work.
Oh, yeah. He's always
posting nudes from movies.
Well, it's funny. It's like, He obviously lays out his website himself, and, you know, it looks like a blog, and he illustrates the articles with whatever photos are the first ones that come up in Google, which often seem to have a nude woman in them. It's like, you're reading his review of Eyes Wide Shut, and it's like, oh, there's Nicole Kidman's ass for some reason, just mm-hmm. staring at me.
I literally just saw this when I was reading, I think it's a review of AI, and then it goes into a Fellini film, and it's just asses right away. So, you know.
It's a strange, one of his many strange quirks.
Mm. I mean, you interviewed Jonathan Rosenbaum.
I did. I mean, I found him delightful. And he's still, like, incredibly engaged. He's still challenging himself. He's still, like, trying to find the next horizon.
And if you wanted to check one of his books, I would say check out Essential Cinema. That's usually the one I picked up first, and that's the one I would recommend to people. Mm-hmm. So, as per usual, you can send us letters at importantcinemaclubpodcast@gmail.com.
Well, this week on our Patreon, every month we like to tell you what we've been watching this month. We like to have a free-flowing discussion of movies.
And more movies.
And more movies. Stuff we haven't talked about on the podcast.
I mean, we could go away from movies. You have some Vanderpump Rules updates. Is there a new season playing that you've been checking out?
You know, I'm wearing my Vanderpump Rules shirt right now. It says
number one guy in the group. I don't know what that is. Maybe Will can explain to me the Vanderpump Rules world and how it's going.
I can talk about that all night long. Let's
Vanderpump cast. So that's on our Patreon, patreon.com/theimportantcinemaclub. Next week, it's about time we did one for the dads out there, right, Will?
That's right. We are going to be talking about a director.
Mm.
Yes, he is a director.
Oscar-winning director.
His movie that he won an Oscar for, better than Goodfellas, mm-hmm. according to the Academy.
Yep, sweeped the awards. Sweeped them.
And the ones he made after that, even better.
That's right.
We're talking about Kevin Costner,
who has been recently making the news because he self-funded a multi-part Western epic that he stars in. You know what? He's taken that wild Yellowstone money that he made, a show that he left, basically, to make these movies, and he's living the dream. He's doing good. What I always say about all rich people should do, like, go make your movies that you want to make.
Good for him. Him and Coppola, mm-hmm. you know?
And so we'll be talking about Dances with Wolves, The Postman, Open Range, Waterworld.
Hell,
he supposedly
yeah.
ghost directed that one.
That's right. That's
now,
right.
We were talking right before we hit record on this that, like, do we need to watch The Postman again? Because it feels like it's in my bones because it was always playing on TV when I was a kid.
I saw it on TV when I was a kid, and I truly don't think it's going to get better.
No. But you've never seen Dances with Wolves, right?
No, never have.
Which is a movie, huge award winner. I don't think people watch it anymore, other than to talk about it dismissively.
That's a good question. I mean, maybe some people do. Mm-hmm. A lot of people watch Yellowstone.
Yeah, people love Yellowstone.
Not my friends.
My dad likes it. I remember talking to one filmmaker who I interviewed for something, an older man, and I was like, oh, what are you watching? He's like, I love Yellowstone. And I literally started saying, yeah, my dad, and I stopped, and the director went, yeah, I know.
A lot of, I don't know, there were a lot of parallel realities all happening at once.
Mm, you know? It's not just us, you know? So that's what we'll be talking about next week. Kevin Costner, the director. So until then, my name's Justin Clue.
I'm Will Sloan.
Thanks for listening. As per usual, I would like to thank some of our new patrons, who include Erky, Dylan Waite, Carlo V, Seamus Turner Glennon, Giallozilla, Bobby, Elliot, Whole Bowl of Fun, David Watkins, Natalie, Frida Granados, Mona Weiser, Benny Mordushowitz, Trone Tropcourt, and Dean Soy. Thank you very much for becoming patrons. We could not keep doing this without you. Well, I've been hearing that something's been grinding your gears lately.
Yeah, what's my beef? David, I'll tell you what's my beef. So I was, of course, revisiting Jonathan Rosenbaum's article about Luc Mouley. And the first line is a quote from Luc Mouley. He said, "Every film by Gerd Oswald deserves a long review." So, of course, that gets me pretty excited. I think Gerd Oswald, I don't know that name. I'm panning for Termite Art Gold. So, you know, I go to Letterboxd, and Letterboxd very helpfully list the movies in order of popularity. Number one, of course, Robert Wagner in A Kiss Before Dying. I don't know why I said of course.
We all know Robert Wagner's A Kiss Before Dying.
Who watches that? Number two, Crime of Passion. The fourth most popular one is called Agent for Harm, H-A-R-M, an acronym. And I see that and I think, I know that title. That was on Mystery Science Theater. I'm pretty sure. So then I click on the Letterboxd page and I think, I wonder if it's good. All the top reviews, every review says, watched on Mystery Science Theater. Top review says, brutally boring, even for a cheap 007 knockoff. And I just want to say, I'm a little tired of this. I'm a little tired of every time those insolent little robots. Listen, it's terrible that they were stranded in space. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
That's an awful thing to do to robots. But every time they talk over a movie, you go on Letterboxd and it's
people saying stuff like, "This movie is only watchable as the MST3K version."
That's right. And what are the movies they're talking about? They're talking about like This Island Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Movies that are watchable.
Now, why do you think this is bothering you particularly now? MST3K has something that has come up again and again on this podcast. It is a defining element of you as a person.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love MST3K. And I can never like divorce myself from
it. No, you can't.
Because when they bury me in the ground, I want to be buried with my DVD copy of Red Zone Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Those voices of those robots, like they're part of me. They're in my DNA, just like the postman is in yours, as we've established.
But now, when you just see people talk about these MST3K films on Letterboxd, there's something that like it triggers in you.
You know, it bothers me because like, how about you didn't actually watch the movie, first of all.
Yes.
You watched a cut down version of the movie, probably looking horrible.
Yeah.
You know, pan and scan and faded.
I think what bothers you is that the people doing that stuff, they think they're better than the movie.
They don't respect the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, when you watch those MST3K episodes, except in rare circumstances, they don't even really make fun of the movie. It's just a meta commentary about.
Yeah.
It's somebody comes on screen and they say, "Hey, that looks like another guy."
You don't think they make fun of the movie? I think they make fun of the movie most of the time.
Well, I'm getting to this too, because I just watched Walking Tall again. Not a great movie.
No.
But Jodan Baker's performance in it, I think, is quite strong.
It all comes back to Jodan Baker.
I was feeling kind of indignant that you can't mention Jodan Baker without people saying, "Oh, Mitchell. Oh,
yeah.
You guys watch Jodan Baker movies," you know? And I just think like, you know, yeah, okay, if you have those little robots talking in your ear the whole time, of course you'll think it's bad. But here's my challenge to all of you. Watch Mitchell without the commentary. And you will find that those robots have lied to you.
Yes.
The movie is not great. It's also not that bad.
This is like the third defense of Mitchell, maybe fourth, that we had on this podcast.
And also, just from a practical standpoint, I use Letterboxd so I can find out, is this movie any good? And what do the people who care about movies, think about this movie? So when I go to Agent for Harm while I'm trying to figure out who's Gerd, what's his name, I want to know, how does this movie actually stack up? And I don't want to see like, "Oh, I watched it with a bunch of little silhouettes making jokes."
Now, I do want to say, anytime this comes up, people will always come out and say, "But MST3K introduced me to these movies. I would not have discovered them anyway."
My story is similar to yours.
Yes. But you just That's fine. You just don't like everybody else watching the movies this way.
I just don't log it on Letterboxd, okay?
Oh, really?
That's what I would say. And look, there are bigger problems happening in the world right now.
Yes. But this one, you're seeing it right in front of you.
Well, exactly.
You can't get away from it.
Oh, I can shut out the atrocities overseas.
Yes.
But
when you're trying to look up a filmmaker you've never heard about, you see those MST3K. What is the solution here, though?
The solution is Letterboxd should institute pages for the MST3K episodes.
Oh, I agree with
because
that.
Because I think you can say that's TV. It isn't really. Those are movies. Mm-hmm. Those are recontextualized movies. Like, hey, we have a page for What's Up, Tiger Lily.
Yeah. Letterboxd does not like alternative versions of things, though. They often get deleted off Letterboxd.
But that has to change, because listen, What's Up, Tiger Lily, that's mostly that Japanese spy movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who watch What's Up, Tiger Lily can log that and not pretend that they've seen the Japanese spy movie.
So what you want Letterboxd to do, or someone out there, you make pages for the MST3K versions of those movies.
And then you can have your little fun and you can quote your little quips.
Yeah, and then I don't gotta see them when I look up those movies.
That's right.
There's always a sense of like dread when I look up a movie. It's like, that seems interesting. And I see like tons of reviews. I was like, why is... Oh, it's an MST3K thing.
And it's metastasized now that there's riff tracks.
Ugh,
so now that...
That's the worst.
Now that if they've riff tracked it, now there are all these movies that aren't even MST3K movies. I thought we'd contained it to just the 12 seasons or whatever of that show.
And for the record, you are not a fan of riff tracks, right?
Listen, it's funny.
Yeah, you can get entertainment from it.
I like riff tracks well enough. Although, you know, I think Mike is a little, you know...
Yeah.
He's a little weird.
Yeah. A little, problematic, if you will.
I didn't like that interview he gave where he was like, Carnival of Souls, that's a bad movie. Why does anybody care about that?
Yes.
That really speaks to the ethos of riff tracks.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you don't like movies, you can listen to riff tracks.
Yeah. Hey, I've enjoyed riff tracks. I'm trying to be nuanced.
Yeah, you're trying to... That there's some funny riff track. Just like I, you know, was very anti-MST3K a decade ago. My friend showed me a bunch of episodes, and I was like, oh, these are really funny. I don't know what else to say. Like, these rule.
And as I said even last week, Final Justice, MST3K. Watch that. Don't watch...
Absolutely.
Don't watch the Graydon Clark film.
But when you log it, MST3K Final Justice.
Correct.